And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to hear an announcement of a new technology that will change the world. From the dread of oil to the hope of solar. Energy Light. When we return, we bring you the clear path to a sustainable world as the voice of the Earth speaks through the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Has there ever been a time when the weather has so dominated the news? Here in Southern California, we are experiencing a relentless rain that has turned our normally sublime lives into a torrent of threats from collapsing hillsides, sudden sinkholes, ravaged roadways, and on the bright side, reservoirs once again bulging with water. Is this just a coincidence, or is there a bigger story? In the U.S., we are still playing make-believe with our future, as we are still arguing whether climate change is really just those nature wackos trying to scare us to think us into considering alternative energies. Meanwhile, in Europe, Japan, and China, whole nations are building economies on new technologies. So, no better time than right now to let you know about a new solar technology that is about to change the way we think of the word alternative. In our first segment, we talk with John and Inga Lang, two German physicists who have spent the last 20 years of their lives in Southern California, applying their genius to invent and forge the breakthrough that the world needs now. It's a solar generation system that takes light leaps ahead of current technologies. I am proud to bring this story, solution, and opportunity to the world. And in our last segment, we head up the coast of Northern California as our National Park of the Week series continues from the Muir Woods National Monument. So after a brief look at the news, the Voice of the Earth brings you answers, hope, and wonder here on the Wild Side News. And now, the news. It's a strange story. The murder of a 74-year-old nun who had been active in working to preserve the hardwood-rich forests in Pará State in Brazil. The onslaught of illegal logging threatened not only the ancient Brazilian forests, but the people who called them their homes. The head of Brazil's environmental agency has announced a dramatic crackdown on illegal loggers and ranchers as a result of her death. Brazil created vast environmental reserves and sent its army of federal police to fight deforestation last week after international outrage at the murder of prominent U.S. human rights activist Dorothy Stang. Luis Fernando Krieger Marico, interim president of Brazil's environmental agency, declared, "This is the turning point. There will be a noticeable fall in deforestation between 2004 and 2005. This decline will be progressive from now on." It is a sad but worthy tribute to a brave woman of the Amazon forest. The head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has drafted a memo to all agency personnel stating that he is unhappy with and seeking alternatives to the Bush administration's competitive sourcing program, which is forcing government agencies to put various job categories up for competitive bidding from the private sector. In a recent bid, the 659 U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologists have been placed in competition with the private sector to carry out their field studies and analysis. In a recent email, Director Steve Williams states, "I believe that the Biological Services study needs further consideration. I have recommended to the Assistant Secretary of Policy, Management, and Budget that we terminate the Aquatic Species Husbandry competition and we review the Biological Services study to determine whether we can conduct this competition in a way that meets the goals of the President's management agenda. The process of replacing government employees who conduct field research on rivers, lakes, species, and trends could be considered by some to open the possibility of tainted reports that may try to court favor with existing government administrators." On a similar note, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee was served with a $3,500 fine by the Department of Justice for rescuing a threatened species of rare Chiricahua leopard frog from circumstances that would lead to their certain destruction. This is the only prosecution on record of a wildlife refuge manager for a conservation-related offense. We will be looking at this story in the weeks ahead. And in New York and San Francisco and other places, the seas are being harnessed with bobbing buoys, submerged turbines, and other systems to harness the extraordinary forces of the sea. The advantages are obvious. It is always there, for starters. It is fairly predictable. Most of the systems are either submerged or float on the surface. Wind turbines become more efficient as humidity increases due to the denser air. Ocean-powered turbines, powered by ocean currents and swells, can therefore harness 1,000 times more energy. Finally, people are beginning to get smart. And that's just the start. And that's the news.
As you both well know, the planet has reached a point where its living systems are really at risk.
In danger.
Those of us who pay attention know that. But for some reason, it's so difficult to get this message out to mainstream Americans. I'd love to know why.
Why? It's very simple. There are too many people who make their living from energy, from oil sales, oil, and from coal, from all these things. And therefore, it is very difficult to get them away from the source of their income. And therefore, many people, even in government, are not too much enthusiastic about what we are doing. We are colleagues from university. We are both physicists, and we did all things except environment. So we invented new blowers. A tangential blower is my invention. We have 84 licensees like GE, like Nodalco, like Gillette, and so on. And 22 years ago, we decided we stop and we do only solar.
82, we got our first patent on solar in 1982 about solar power plant. But it's a different system than the one we have now. It took us 20 years to get to the simple ones.
The principle is the same.
What made you come up with the decision to focus entirely on solar?
Because wind is something that is close to the shore, on mountains pretty good, but that is an indirect use of solar energy. So we decided solar fits in our field of knowledge. We believe we could make it in 5 years. Then it was 10 years, it was 15 years, and finally, now we are ready. So you have to go to come with us to our test unit in El Cajon. That should convince people that this technology is possible. Why? And that is the secret. Two axes following or tracking the sun is very well known. The well-known systems are highly expensive. So we found a way how to get away from this need of high precision. This I want to show you here on an instrument.
Okay, I'm looking at a small device here. It's cast, it looks like, out of aluminum. It has some fins on it and some sort of a square aperture. Oh, and then also a little meter. Very good, yeah. Okay, John is shining a laser beam into this unit, and we're kind of watching to see what happens here. Okay.
You have here, what is it, 16?
Yes.
And the interesting is, it doesn't matter where I bring the beam down, I can go in the corner, I can go in the middle, I can go wherever I want, it is always the same number. And in addition, we developed a new kind of lens, a lens that is not a Fresnel lens anymore. It is a lens with internal reflection. And that gives us a possibility to make a very short pencil of rays. This very, very short pencil of rays accumulates on a point of only 2.8 millimeter diameter, so a tenth of an inch. This little spot is not bigger than the spot from this laser, but it has a intensity that you can melt metals.
It concentrates the sun to 400 suns in this small point, and that's why it's extremely hot there.
And this focal point of only 2.8 millimeter diameter comes down on our secondary optic, and this point will be spread in such a way that all parts of the cell get the same amount of energy and almost vertical. So we have no losses here anymore. This is the most important invention, and this is the one that gives us the possibility to build a unit that was till now too expensive at a price that can compete with everything else. That means compared with normal systems, let's say with flat plate systems, we make it for half the money.
I need to understand that. Everyone is familiar pretty much with the standard solar panel.
Yeah.
They typically come in sizes like 1 by 4 feet or variations on that. They're putting out now, I don't know, anywhere from, 30 to 50 or 60 watts in that 1 by 4 foot panel.
The cell, these kind of cells have an efficiency of average 11%. After 3 years sunshine, it goes down to about 8.5%. So conversion of the sun's energy into electricity is very bad.
Renewable energy lab. And the people from NREL gave us this certificate, and it has an efficiency of 37.3%.
Which is about 300% greater than your standard solar panel that we see tonight.
That's correct. So this cell now absorbs the concentrated rays, and that is what people don't believe. We get almost 800 times, more than 800 times, of electricity out of a cell of the same size of a conventional.
You have to say that we concentrate the sun to 400 X and have a cell which has a much higher efficiency. So our cell is only 1.5 by 1.5 centimeter large, and the per watt we have costs of $0.64, and in the one sun cells it's $4 to $5 per watt.
Now we will be able to compete in price. We are able to compete with coal-fired and oil-fired units.
The standard solar panel is about 1 by 4 feet or 1 by 3 feet, and they vary. If I were to take three of these, therefore it would be essentially 1 by 3 feet, what kind of energy production could we capture from that?
11% efficiency means from a square meter you get 110, theoretically 110 watts. In practice, it goes then down to 85 or so. In our case, a square meter has 300 watts. So that is a totally different dimension. And therefore, we get also per square unit of the plant much, much more. So to we compare with the largest solar plant in the world, that is in Daggett, that is Solar 2. We are 14.6 times better. But if we compare it with a chimney type of power plant, then we are 180 times better. We get 180 times more energy from the same acre of ground.
that's dramatically significant. A lot of people complain because in traditional forms, you have to have huge arrays in order to produce effectively solar. So that if we're able to therefore concentrate this, we're able to use a much smaller collector to produce the same amount of energy, and then people start saying, well, that's practical. That's a reasonable solution.
So we need only a 16th of space if we compare it with solar one.
Well, that's a huge step forward. Now, is it going to cost more for your system, or the same, or less than traditional?
The silicon cell per watt is almost 1,100 grams. Ours is 0.076 grams. That is 14,000 times less. The next one is a very important figure. That is, how much energy do we get per square centimeter? The conventional cell brings 0.011 watt per square centimeter. Ours, 13.6 watt per square centimeter. That means 1,236 times more. The same cell. Now comes the price per watt. We are much cheaper. 5 times, 6 times, 7 times cheaper than cells today. The important thing is, if you have the same surface of cell, we are 1,236 times better. That means we get 1,236 times more electricity as the conventional silicon cell.
When we return, we visit a working demonstration of the Pyron solar generator here on the Wild Side News.
Well, I'm standing in front of the... How do you like to refer to this system?
Oh, that's a Pyron power plant.
Okay, this would be a Pyron power plant, and it's actually sitting in like a large wading pool, which is about, oh, I don't know, the water here is probably about 18 inches, maybe 20 inches,
yes.
But I understand it could actually be even less than that.
Yeah, 18 centimeter would be enough.
Now, how many do you call these collectors, the individual units, what do you refer to them as?
Modules. So the modules, 10 modules fill one trough. As you see in the middle, they are all the same. And in each module has a lens with and a secondary optic and a cell and obviously the cooling device. It's all integrated in a little tube.
Yes, and so this whole system floats on the tank. It's how wide is that? Give it, and it's best if you could talk in terms of feet. Some of the audience doesn't understand meters so well.
23 feet diameter, and it rotates on a swimming tube. So very, very simple, and with almost no friction, and a very little motor. It is a motor with only less than 1 watt, drives this according to the azimuth of the sun, and the troughs are tilting around in vertical axis for the elevation of the sun.
Right, and that actually changes very slowly, that elevation changes.
Oh, yes. So in the elevation is in the morning visible, and then it goes slow, and at noontime it reaches zero, and then it goes the opposite way.
Well, I think one of the things that is so extraordinarily elegant about the system is the fact that the total servo mechanism to control this array, which, and how many actual modules are there in this array?
288.
There's 288 modules in this array. Is controlled by a total of 3 watts worth of energy consumption, which is nothing. So just that alone is an incredible efficiency right there.
The solar tracker, and that has two systems. One guides the azimuth motor that is here, this little tire, and the other one, the elevation.
Yeah, this array that has 200 and some modules on it is a big. It's like a big wheel. It's a big, looks like aluminum or something wheel that floats, and then each one of the collections of modules. How do you refer to a stack of modules?
That is a trough, and in a trough are 10 modules.
In its largest.
In the middle, there are. In large units, you have more or less only the long ones.
And so anyways, all of these literally float on the water, and therefore the entire system can easily rotate. There's just one, it's a wheelbarrow tire, for all intents and purposes, that just drives the entire system to track the sun as it moves from east to west throughout the day. And quite honestly, if I may say so, it's brilliant.
Here is a propeller from an ultralight aircraft, and the propeller is driven by a DC motor, and the DC motor is driven by a part of the troughs. So it's very noisy, but yes. It indicates how much energy we produce.
Now, this particular array could produce how many watts?
6,600 watts. So 6.6 kilowatt, yes.
And that, of course, would be during sun time.
Yeah, that is at noon time. In the early morning it is less, and late afternoon is less too. Not much, no.
Well, that's an incredible advantage right there, because in typical flat solar panels, you get a terrific drop-off in the mornings and the evenings.
So that we get all the energy, all the radiation of the sun that attaches this system 100% into the cell.
Now, have you been able to determine, let's say if this was in production, a unit like this, what the actual cost to a consumer might be?
We believe that we are around $2 per watt. That means $2,000 per kilowatt. That is much, much, much less than the today's systems. They cost $6,500 or $8,000. The Solar 2 has even cost $22,000.
So, just in terms of practical, if I were to buy this, if I were to say, I want to buy this, how much would it cost me? I'm talking about when you're in actual production, not this one, but you understand.
Yeah, then you have to pay for each kilowatt, $2,000, for 6 kilowatt, $12,000. And then you have, for 25 years, electricity.
What would you estimate in terms of the number of homes, for example, a unit like this might power?
A normal house requires continuous load from about 950 watts. Except you switch on the air conditioner, then it jumps up to 4 kilowatt. So
air conditioner 2, otherwise 6 houses.
And of course that's using these ancient devices. And you know, the whole trick to this future is to now inspire new devices that are much more energy efficient and integrate that. We need to integrate these systems.
Yeah, we certainly have to change the whole system to low energy consumers. but we think we are on the way.
So a person invests their, we'll say, $12,000 in a unit like this, and in terms, now of course you haven't had a chance to really test this out for 25 years, but what would you say would be the maintenance on a unit like this?
There's very, very, very little, because it is all very safe, and the only necessity is for this system to clean the lenses, but the new systems have a spray bar, and so they are automatically cleaned every evening.
Well, I sure like this better than I do great big huge wind-driven propeller generators that really I think are not that attractive in the landscape.
And this makes no noise and doesn't pollute.
And actually, in terms of moving parts, it's the simplest moving parts I've ever seen in my life.
That's right. So that is a very important advantage of our system, that we have practically no precision mechanics. These are all ball bearings from plastic, and they don't require lubrication, nor do they wear, because we move them only once a day, 60 degrees in one direction, then backwards 60 degrees the other direction.
Very, very impressive. Very impressive. Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We continue our story on this breakthrough in solar technology that will lead to a serious alternative sustainable energy future for us and for the world. What's it going to take? Listen.
Well, again, John and Inga Lang, we continue our conversation. And I've had a chance to look at the your system. And if I had to give an analysis, I'd say I think you've got yourself an amazingly interesting new technology. And I congratulate you for the elegance of the design and the breadth of the application, you know. So here's the real question then. It seems as if to me this is a technology that is ready to actually go into production.
Yes, it is intended also to continue. We started a little production already for the high-tech parts, but we have to invest in the rigs and tools for the low-tech units, because it is intended that we get only coils of aluminum and build the troughs and the material at the site, so that we have no transport problems.
So far, we could do it on our own, but now we also need help. Financial help and manpower.
Well, that's called investment. So let's say that investment came in. How long would it be before this became at least initially operational?
The very first one would be after maybe 5-6 months, but in real production requires a year.
Now, your vision really is not to limit production to just San Diego, but really to be able to make this available to the world.
Yeah, we are looking for franchisees all over the world, and we will always supply the high-tech parts, the lenses, and the conduit with cell, and the low-tech parts will be done in the country, on the site. And we will train franchisees and deliver the necessary tools and jigs.
It seems to me, as I look at this, that it's a good strategy in the sense that the high-tech parts are very small, and that the low-tech parts are very big and relatively easy to manufacture and assemble.
That's right. It's easy to make them, so they could be made in any place in the world, but they are labor-intensive. Therefore, the price will be depending from the labor cost in the country where the site is built.
So let's say that, let's say a year or two from now, you're actually in production. What would be the application? Let's talk first of all, for example, in the United States. How might this affect homes, neighborhoods, towns, and cities?
The first approach is end of the line unit. That means the lines going far away from the power plant can feed the clients, but as soon as the sun comes, as it gets hot, then the average consumption of 950 watts goes up to 4 kilowatt, and that is then too much for the system, and therefore they need on the end of the line, of the end of the power grid, they need solar power, and that is coincides with sunshine and hot and need of air conditioning, yes.
It isn't just a matter of producing electricity. You're also very interested in utilizing these systems as a source to efficiently produce hydrogen, which certainly is part of the future. And I think that's a very important aspect of this as well, that it becomes a very transportable, efficient way of creating hydrogen.
We don't only want to produce hydrogen by electrolysis, but also hydrogen and oxygen, so that we can produce electricity overnight when we don't have sun.
Magneto hydrogen dynamic system is an old, well-known principle, but it never worked with air, because air contains 70% of nitrogen, and the nitrogen is a ballast, is well without value, but it has to be heated up, and therefore they never reached with systems in the operation the high efficiency. We are the only one who can recombine hydrogen with oxygen, and then we get temperatures far, far above 3,000 centigrade, even above 3,300 centigrade.
There is the rudimentary form, which is what we've been talking about, which are the solar arrays that would produce electricity and or be utilized to produce hydrogen. And it gets rather technical at this point, so at some point I think what people need to do is to visit the website and or contact John and Inga to understand that this is just the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what is possible in utilizing a full arena of not only the production but also what we might call the waste energy, because there is a lot of other heat and other things that are available in this process that can be converted through a rather elegant plasma technology that has secondary and tertiary opportunities for serious energy production.
So we will make use from existing generators and will feed them with our oxygen and with our hydrogen in the stoichiometrically right ratio. That is 2-to-1, and therefore we have the possibility to produce the hottest flame on Earth. The hottest flames that are highly dissociated into negative carriers and positive carriers of electricity. And this electricity is a second possibility to make a huge quantities night electricity.
Well, as I say, that particular technology is one that deserves almost another show and becomes very technical, but it's really thrilling. I have a mild understanding of what we're talking about. So, John, how would this technology compare? There are a lot of efforts at solar, but you really see the potential for this to become much more than just solar power, but actually solar generating systems for whole communities.
We could produce electricity for whole countries if we have desert space available, and we have the sun and we should use it. We also can use it for smaller communities, but it has no limit size, so we can put it in any size.
It has the potential to substitute coal burning and oil burning, and the possibility would be that in a very short time it could feed very large areas to substitute the whole electricity consumption of the United States. Requires desert area from 30 by 30 kilometer. These areas are available in west of America.
That's a very hopeful vision. Very hopeful vision. On a little different angle, John, what drives these ideas? Is it strictly your background in physics and the desire to invent, or are there other things that drive your mission to bring this technology to the world, which you just have done and you are about ready to launch?
It's very difficult to say. Number one, it is necessary that new energy will be created, will be made available for the public. But number two is we developed in 22 years all the basic elements, and now we are ready to start production of these power plants that can substitute existing coal-fired and oil-fired units.
Inga, I can sense that you actually have quite a passion for nature and the environment.
I think it's impossible that we don't use the sun when we can, and instead we do something to hurt our environment, and I hate it, and I also hate it when all the trees are gone, and when this terrible storm was in Haiti, the damage was only so big because there were no trees left. In the neighboring country, the Dominican Republic, they had trees, there was no damage. Why do we do this? Same rain, but no damage, because they still have their forests, and we should protect the environment.
Where did the name pyron come from?
Pyrolytic means made by high temperature. So conversion by super high temperature. That was the basis of pyron.
It's hard to know what can happen and what is possible, but it certainly seems as if there is a technology available here that the world should know about. And I'm glad that I can bring this to the world on the Wild Side News. John and Inga, if people wish to learn about your technologies, how can they do so? We may have people who are interested from anywhere in the world.
Email or website. Our email is pyroninc@aol.com. Our website is pyronsolar.com.
It's up to you, all of you, and us. Please contact John and Inga if you want to invest your hopes and more in your future. When we return, it's off to the woods, the big woods, the redwoods of Muir Woods National Monument, as we continue the story of the voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Along with Henry David Thoreau, no single person carries so much of the legacy of the American conservation movement than John Muir. We now head on up to San Francisco as the Voice of the Earth honors our National Park of the Week, Muir Woods.
I want to invite Heather Booth to the Wild Side News. Heather is one of the rangers at the Muir Woods National Monument. Heather, give us a picture of Muir Woods.
Well, Muir Woods is an old-growth coast redwood forest just 12 miles north of San Francisco. Lots of towering redwood trees and a lush understory in the forest as well.
And how large a park is this?
It's actually a quite small park. It's only about 550 acres. But it is surrounded by other parkland, state, national, local water districts. So it's actually a pretty wild area.
Now, of course, Muir Woods conjures up a lot of different images to different people. Certainly, we're talking about John Muir, and he has a reputation as being probably one of America's most significant conservationists and writers, and is considered by many to be one of the fathers of the modern environmental movement. Tell us how you interpret John Muir and this park.
Well, Muirwood is in many ways a monument to his legacy. Ironically, this is one of the very few, well, I wouldn't say one of the few parks, but John Muir actually fought to protect many parks throughout the United States and actually around the world, and this is one of the parks that he didn't actually campaign individually to protect, but instead it was named in his honor because William Kent, who actually purchased this land and donated it to become a national monument, admired John Muir greatly, and it was John Muir's writings about nature and the preservation of nature that really inspired him.
It is kind of an unusual thing now, because Kent was a wealthy industrial person, and
correct,
apparently this particular area became threatened with logging as the redwoods were being torn down, and this is an area of incredible redwood forest. Tell us that story.
Well, historically in California, there were about 2 million acres of redwoods, and today you still would find about 1.7 million acres of redwoods growing, but less than 3% of the old-growth, uncut forests remain today and protected in parklands. And when Kent was here at the turn of the century, he was seeing the devastation that was happening. You know, in California, there were plenty of redwoods up until about the gold rush when the population of California exploded. And really, within about 50 years, most of the trees in the Bay Area were cut down. One of the advantages this area had going for it, and at that time it was known as Redwood Valley or Sequoia Canyon alternately, and it was just really hard to get to. And, you know, some of the tallest trees, some of the tallest redwoods anywhere usually grow in these really steep canyons, so it's not surprising to find the trees here. But we were just really lucky that geography protected them up until William Kent and some other local citizens could come together and start suggesting that we needed to preserve some of these trees for the future.
So when people come to Muir Woods National Monument, which is, what, about 12 miles north of San Francisco proper?
Yeah, exactly, by a very, very windy road.
That's always part of the adventure of traveling that part of the country. Beautiful, interesting realities. What is their experience going to be like?
Well, they come into our main parking lot, and then they get out of their cars. This is a walking park. And immediately after passing through our visitor center, they will enter into this old-growth redwood forest. It's like taking a step back in time. This is the kind of forest dinosaurs would have been walking through. And they'll be walking into a deep, damp, cool forest, even in the summer when it's 100 degrees in the rest of Marin County. It'll be in the 60s or maybe the 70s in here. It's often foggy during the summer, rainy during the winter. It's not to say we don't have beautiful days. I'm looking out at a gorgeous day at Muir Woods right now. But this cool, damp weather really provides the right habitat for the redwood trees and the plants and animals that the forest supports.
You're a very lucky person in the sense that you get to witness this transformation from people who perhaps have never even experienced the redwoods, and they park their car, they get out, they walk through your visitor center and look at a few exhibits and things, and then they emerge into this other world. What do you notice when people, what happens?
Well, one of the things I love about working in this particular park is that we get visitors who have never been to a national park. They've never really had that experience in nature. But even the people who have been to other parks come here, and they're just amazed that this kind of place can exist so close to a large urban area, because it's such a wilderness feel just half an hour from San Francisco. And they immediately start seeing the wildlife. Our banana slugs, which are ubiquitous in a redwood forest, just fascinate the children. It's really a wonderful thing to be able to show a slimy creature to a kid. And they just become quiet. It's interesting to me that we have a lot of rules that regulate how our visitors behave. You know, they can't take things home, they can't go off trail, etc. But we don't have any signs up that say, please be quiet. And yet you hear people speaking in hushes as they walk through the park. There's something about the forest that just makes people very respectful and very quiet. It's quite a spiritual experience for a lot of people.
Well, if people have not experienced the redwoods, it is totally unique. There is almost nothing that really compares. Certainly going to the Grand Canyon and seeing the expansive vistas and the deep, deep canyon puts things into perspective. And there's a sense of awe there, too. But there's something, as you say, sort of mystical. And I guess I knew that's the mists and the mystical are related.
Probably very much. That fog also absorbs a lot of that sound. So it's sort of part and parcel. And then, of course, there's the age of the trees. You know, redwood trees can get over 370 feet tall, so that's the visual aspect. But knowing that the trees here average about 500 to 800 years old and that they can live over 2,000 years, you know, knowing that the trees that we're walking underneath were the same trees that John Muir and William Kent walked underneath, and for that matter, that the native peoples walked under before them, these trees were growing when Columbus arrived in America. They were growing during the American Revolution. It kind of puts our lifetimes in perspective.
What do you think it was about John Muir and his writings that made such an impact on America, and particularly awakening this concept that we must conserve and preserve? He literally was a preservationist, these treasures.
Well, John Muir is a man I've always greatly admired, partially because he was so intelligent, and he was also very eloquent, very, for a person who's often described for the many treks he took on his own, climbing across the Sierra, exploring mountains, climbing trees, he was also very good at politics. He was very good at helping other people to see what he saw and convince them to help protect landscapes. You know, there's a lot of people out there who go out and explore and think the outdoors are wonderful, but very few of them can get as many articles and books published as John Muir did and have as wide a distribution. And then John Muir actually started acting on his convictions. Not only did he write these books and talk to the people he knew, he went on to establish the Sierra Club, which became a very potent political group and still remains that today. The Sierra Club's first campaign helped preserve Yosemite as a national park. Previous to that, it had been only preserved partially as a state grant. So his work just carries on today, and I think Kent really was inspired by him because Muir had done so much to convince other people about this. And Kent was also really a progressive. He felt like the private citizens, the wealthy citizens of the world, should not have exclusive access to areas like this. He felt that other people should have access to these public lands, that they really should belong to all of us.
One of the things that you interpret as well is a unique sort of panoply of players. You have Kent and you have Muir, but you also have an ancient tribute tree to a legendary conservationist. Tell that story, because this puts the modern era into perspective and some of the things that we're struggling with these days to determine our future.
Very much so. Muir Woods, one of our main themes is history of conservation, and so many things come together here. John Muir, of course, the park is named for, so that seems the most obvious, but it's actually Kent and Gifford Pinchot's legacy that we're really exhibiting here. Gifford Pinchot was really the father of forestry in the United States. Not necessarily in the way we think of it today, but at the turn of the century, he and John Muir, hand in hand, were saying that private lands weren't necessarily the best way to manage the natural resources of this country, and they were advocating the establishment of national parks and national forests. Pinchot went on to become the first chief of the National Forest Service, and he had also become a friend of William Kent. So when Kent was struggling to find a way to protect this park, they both together suggested that it become a national park in 1903, and they were unsuccessful. Congress simply wasn't interested. So in 1905, Kent purchased this land and tried to preserve it for the public. Unfortunately, in 1907, a local water company tried to condemn the land to build a reservoir here. And it was Gifford Pinchot who really offered up the opportunity that Kent could donate this land to the federal government and it could become a national monument under the Antiquities Act. So Theodore Roosevelt, another great conservationist, is actually the one who proclaimed this a national monument in 1908. So these people all coming together really were, you know, the nexus of a nascent environmental movement going on. In 1914, legislation was passed to build a reservoir in Yosemite. Hetch Hetchy Reservoir now exists there. And this was really the first big fight of the environmental movement. And John Muir was fighting against it. William Kent, ironically, at that point, had become a congressman from the Bay Area and actually had co-written the legislation to create that reservoir. So all of these people really played a role in the early conservation history of the United States.
And so these dynamics continue to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
They really do, particularly on public lands.
Oh, yes, very much so. We're always struggling between figuring out what natural resources we need to use, how we can use them carefully, but also what natural resources need to be set aside for their own sake. And that's one of the wonderful things about the different federal agencies we have today, having the National Park Service and the Forest Service with different missions.
Let's move it up to the current era. When people come to Muir Woods National Monument, what should they expect? How much time should they put aside, and what can they expect to do there?
I would say our average visitor spends about 45 minutes to an hour and a half here, and within that time frame, they're able to walk the majority of our main trail. Our main trail is flat, easy walking. It's paved or boardwalk, so it's ADA accessible, which means that you can come here with your family. You can have bring your grandkids in a stroller, and great-grandma, if she needs to use a wheelchair, we have a couple we can loan out. So it's really something for every ability. If you have those adventurous teenagers who want a long, hard hike, we have trails leading out of the canyon that are nice and steep, and they can hike for miles and miles, even to the top of the mountain above us, 2,600 feet uphill. So there's lots of opportunities. We don't allow picnicking here, which is a little bit unusual, and it's a day-use area. And that's largely because we have very high visitation. If visitors come in the summer, it can be very crowded, and we suggest that they come early in the morning or late in the afternoon. Otherwise, our parking lots actually fill up.
And you're a year-round park.
We are. We are open every single day of the year, including Christmas and New Year's Day.
That's actually quite rare.
Well, it's unusual, but what we found is that those are days that are very popular here at the park. You'd be amazed how many people want to come out on Christmas Day or on New Year's Day, and it's wonderful to see all these families. They're on Christmas Day, they're finished unwrapping all their gifts, and they want to come out and take a walk. Or on New Year's Day, they're going to start their New Year's resolution to get some exercise by coming to Muir Woods. It's a great way to start the year.
Much of the rest of the country is still in the grips of winter in one way or another, but actually along the coast in San Francisco, Northern California, this is springtime. And springtime in the Redwoods is a special time for you and your park, and as a matter of fact, you have some special activities that happen each spring.
That's right. You know, Redwood Forests, first of all, they're in a Mediterranean climate where we don't have spring so much as winter and summer. We have 6 months of the wet season and 6 months of a dry season. And it's during that wet season that the forest really comes alive. All of our trees are leafing out right now, but our first flowers started blooming in December. And that's normal every year, which means that if we want to do restoration work to help repair some of the damage we've done in the past, we need to do it during this rainy, wet season. So right now we're actually having an Earth season. Instead of the traditional Earth Day in April, we have invited large corporations, groups, individual volunteers to come out and help us remove invasive plant species or plants, plants that we grow in our native plant nursery, help us do trail repair. There's a lot of things we can do to help make this forest healthy. We've been really lucky the last several years to have 400 or 500 volunteers come out and help us with that, and it's continuing right now.
If people are interested in assisting, can they contact you?
Yeah, they can check out our website at www.nps, as in National Park Service, .gov/muwo, or our nature hotline at 415-388-2595. And those will be able to give you information about the natural and cultural history of the park, learn about our hours, etc., and also find out who to contact for each volunteer program we have.
Now, 2005 is a very unique and special year for Muir Woods.
That's right. We are kicking off our centennial. It's incredible to think that this park has been here for so long. 1905 was the year that William Kent purchased this land and first opened it up to the public as a forest reserve for people to recreate in. So we're celebrating 100 years of preservation. And then 1908, of course, was the year that Kent donated the land to the federal government and that Roosevelt declared it a national monument in honor of John Muir. So in 2008, we'll actually be celebrating the 100th-year anniversary of the National Monument. One other really special thing happening this year is we're actually celebrating another coincidental anniversary. In 1945, the United Nations, during their coordinating conference in San Francisco, came to Muir Woods as part of their celebration. They actually came here for a memorial to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and this year, World Environment Day is happening in San Francisco. The United Nations is having a conference here, and once again, they're going to be coming to Muir Woods as part of their celebration, because it's places like this that can really inspire peace throughout the world.
Great concept. You know, there is a rather colorful historical element within the Muir Woods National Monument, and that is Bohemian Grove.
Yes. Bohemian Grove is one of the places where our tallest trees are. It's a beautiful spot, and the Bohemian Club in San Francisco thought so too. So in 1892, they actually chose this place to have their summer hijinks. And the Bohemian Club is world famous. When it first started out, it was artists and writers, but it very quickly became the organization for wealthy businessmen to belong to. And in 1892, they got together, built a 60-foot-tall statue of a Buddha, and had plays and celebrations here for about 2 weeks. But legend has it, it was so horribly cold and foggy and damp that they said they'd never come back here again. And so within a couple of years, they had actually purchased land up on the Russian River. And today, there's also a Bohemian Grove now on the Russian River where the Bohemian Club continues to have their summer celebrations. Luckily for us, they didn't like Muir Woods, so we got to become a park instead so everyone could enjoy it.
What a great and rich history this relatively small parcel of land has for America in many different respects. I want to thank Heather Booth, who's one of the rangers at Muir Woods National Monument, for joining us on the Wild Side News today. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you for having me.
We have everything to hope for if we will now commit to our future. Let's get this show off the road and onto the path to a future made possible for the generations to come by the wisdom that we possess. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again as we share the voice of the earth heard around the world on the Wild Side News.